Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Florida Tax Watch Prudential Productivity Awards, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost savings ideas on June 21st in Jacksonville, sponsored by Prudential, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plans. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Could Florida's death penalty be facing its own demise?
Numerous people have been executed, under arguably an unconstitutional statute.
Also this week, the head of the Florida Department of Corrections finds herself under the microscope and possibly under the gun.
I was told there was no need, that they weren't going to close this program. So I crawled off of a tractor today, put on a suit, and come to Tallahassee because I was lied to.
We'll also dive into the ongoing battle between supporters of traditional public schools and those who favor expanded school choice, and get the latest on efforts to pull down federal dollars to fight the Zika virus. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. Florida's highest court is weighing a decision that will likely impact all 390 men and women on the state's death row. Nick Evans reports two men in very different places are hoping to see the same thing happen.
It's a little busy today around here.
Florida State Prison sits just outside of Rayford, a sleepy rural town about 30 miles north of Gainesville. It's where Ronald Clark is held.
So who's this in the...
That's me at 21 years old.
Can you describe what you look like?
Long hair, baby face, looked about 15.
He's 48 now. He wears glasses and his hair is short and straight, parted down the middle. He's imposing, well over 6 feet tall and broad-shouldered, with a couple of small faded tattoos scattered along his arms. He was convicted of first-degree murder in 1991 and sentenced to death.
Yeah, 25, 26 years later, here I sit. I come through that back gate there on February 22nd, 1991. And now this Hearst is about all I got to rely on.
Hearst is the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that came down in January, invalidating Florida's death sentencing scheme. Under that system, the jury issued a recommendation, but it was the judge who weighed the evidence and determined the ultimate sentence. Borrowing from a friend of the court brief, Clark says there's no question what should happen now.
It states right there that all these cases, without unambiguously, requires that all capital felonies whose death sentences have been imposed under the now unconstitutional statute be resentenced to life in prison.
Former Florida Supreme Court Chief Justice Harry Anstead lives on a lake just outside of Tallahassee with his wife Sue.
Hello there.
Hi there.
Anstead helped write the brief Clark was reading.
This case, in a sense, is close to my heart because the decision in Hearst is based on an earlier decision from the United States Supreme Court called Ring versus Arizona.
He explains Ring is very similar to Hearst. The court threw out a basically identical death sentencing system in Arizona for the same reasons it struck down Florida's in Hearst. But when a Florida death row inmate appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court based on Ring, the court chose not to take it up. Anstead says that tied his court's hands, but he wrote a separate opinion, taking issue with the higher court's decision.
I was a lone dissent to that decision and wrote and essentially what the U.S. Supreme Court wrote in their decision a few months ago, that all you have to do is examine the Florida statute and you will see that it does not comply with the Ring requirement that juries make those findings.
That was back in 2002. Now that the Supreme Court has ruled against Florida's capital sentencing system, he believes all 390 death row inmates should have their sentences commuted to life in prison. And there's precedent for that. After a 1970s ruling temporarily halted executions across the country, Florida commuted nearly 100 sentences. But even if wholesale reductions aren't in the cards, the Hearst ruling will touch off a wave of new appeals. Clark, though, well, he's not holding his breath. Earlier this month, he got word the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has denied his case. He hasn't told his mother yet.
I mean, I found out last week, and I did not want to tell her on Mother's Day. So, yeah. My attorney will file a rehearing. That'll get denied. She'll then file certiorari in the U.S. Supreme Court. That'll get denied. Yeah, I'm pessimistic because I already know. I don't look for the courts to help me out any.
Anstead is a bit more hopeful, but the passage of time between that first opinion and the Hearst ruling weighs on him.
Since that time in Florida, okay, I don't know the exact number. Maybe you do. But numerous people have been executed, okay, under arguably an unconstitutional statute.
In the 14 years since Ring, there have been 41 executions. The last one came on January 7th of this year, 5 days before the Hearst ruling. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Of course, Florida's death row is located in a facility operated by the state's Department of Corrections. Florida's prison chief, Julie Jones, is finding herself under an ever-growing level of scrutiny after reaching a shaky truce with a nonprofit prison rehabilitation group. The dust-up over closing a Bridge of America facility in Broward County underscores the need to help thousands of inmates transition to society, as we hear from Jim Ash.
Jones had no way to predict the fierce backlash that would follow her decision to close a Broward center that provided 172 male inmates with drug and alcohol counseling, GED classes, job training, and life skills. Within days, a grim-faced Bridge of America president, Lori Constantino Brown, was pushing program graduates in front of the cameras at a Tallahassee press conference. People with powerful stories like Dana Love, who tearfully credited Bridges with helping her find sobriety in a career after 12 years behind bars.
I'm overwhelmed, and I appreciate everybody that's trying to help keep this program open. I think that we're more than just a number in a bed. I think that we're humans trying to make the right direction for ourselves.
Lawmakers wrote angry letters, including House Majority Leader Dana Young of Tampa. Senator Darren Soto, an Orlando Democrat, says he wrote one to make sure Jones knows the opposition was bipartisan.
As a Senate committee, we stress our support for these programs. They reduce recidivism and also bring people back into the workforce much quicker.
But a letter wasn't strong enough for Senate Criminal Justice Chairman Greg Evers. The conservative Republican drove from Baker to give the press conference more political heft. Evers told reporters he was planning special budget language to protect the program, but department officials assured him it wasn't necessary.
I was told there was no need, that they weren't going to close this program. So I crawled off of a tractor today, put on a suit, and come to Tallahassee. Because it was lied to.
Department spokesman McKinsey Lewis says no one discussed closing the program with Evers. He says the department objected to the budget language because it would have changed the way the state calculates prison populations. The department needed the Broward facility to free up office space, Lewis says.
This is not about anything personal between the secretary and Bridges. We have great relationships with Bridges of America at many other facilities around the state. This is simply a unique circumstance in Broward County.
Jones and Bridges reached an agreement that calls for closing the Broward facility, but continuing Bridge of America programs at other centers. Jones says there will be a 61-bed net loss, but no disruption of services. Constantino Brown disagrees. She says there will be 122 beds lost and that it'll take 6 months to get a new center up and running.
Not to mention, 40 of my staff who did nothing wrong but do their job, are going to get laid off because, you know, we couldn't negotiate a better deal.
A 2013 Tax Watch study shows there's a lot more at stake than an administrative tug of war. It found that the average recidivism rate in Florida, meaning the number of inmates who return to prison, is 28%. Bridge of America graduates have an average recidivism rate of less than 10%, according to the study. Since some 34,000 prisoners get released every year in Florida, cutting the recidivism rate even a few points means significantly reducing the number of new crime victims, Evers says. And he says that's why he'll be keeping a close eye to make sure the Bridge of America deal works.
I hope that we're we're not putting lipstick on a pig.
Lewis says the department is dedicated to public safety, and it'll bring additional beds online if the need arises. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the ongoing battle between private and public schools continues in Florida.
In some states, alternative schools do much better than others. In some states, virtual schools do better. In some states, charter schools do amazing. And in other states, they don't do that great.
As Congress begins to consider Zika funding proposals, some are hopeful it can get done soon to help Florida with summer on the way.
Hopefully, we can get ahead of it. I think of it like a hurricane. The way you prepare for a hurricane is you get prepared. The federal government needs to come together and provide the funding to our states.
And the state's Economic Development Agency did not get money for incentive programs this year. Now the organization's board and Governor Rick Scott are looking for a way forward.
Right or wrong, the legislature is not going to fund the Quick Action Closing Fund, and I don't see any reason that's going to change this next session. So we've got to think about how we're spending our money.
Florida's largest teachers union is once again taking the state's tax credit scholarship program to court, but it's still not clear if the challengers have a legal leg to stand on. Kate Payne reports.
The Florida Education Association is challenging Step Up for Students, a program that helps low-income students go to private schools. Businesses can donate scholarships in exchange for a tax break from the state. Thousands of teachers rallied against the program earlier this year.
There is no evidence from any other nation that replacing a public school system with a privatized choice system produces anything but social, economic, and racial segregation. While making the rich richer at the expense of our students, so we have to say,
enough is enough.
That's FEA president and the case plaintiff Joanne McCall. She calls the scholarship program unconstitutional, diverting would-be tax dollars to private use. A Leon County judge threw out the case last year, but the union is trying again with the First District Court of Appeals, which heard oral arguments this week. But they can't argue the merits just yet. First, the union must prove they have legal standing, the sort of revolving door that allows certain cases into court. Steve Johnson is a professor at the Florida State University College of Law, and he says standing is tricky.
And I'm not saying that that has happened here, but standing is too often used by judges as a way of avoiding cases that they don't want to decide. As a result, the court, if it doesn't want to hear a case, will announce some change in the standing doctrine. Or if it does want to hear a case, will announce some change in the standing doctrine that allows it to do what it wants.
Here are the union's two main arguments for getting their case heard. First, the scholarship program harms the public system by diverting students and funding to the private sector. But John Kirtley, chair of Step Up, believes the program is a boon to public schools.
If you're taking the two hardest case kids out of a classroom, the teacher's job probably gets easier. It's also helping the taxpayers. Because the law limits the scholarship to 80% of what the state must send to a district to educate a child, it saves the taxpayers money.
But researchers say it's difficult to compare outcomes because private schools aren't held to the same standards as public schools. Maritza Golic is an education policy professor at Florida State University.
So they take tests such as the Stanford Achievement Test, the Terra Nova, the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, or other types of tests, but they don't take the FSA, the Florida Standard Assessment. So it's a little difficult to compare outcomes between, you know, two groups of students who take two different tests.
The union's second argument is taxpayer standing, the ability of Florida taxpayers to challenge appropriations by the legislature. It all boils down to this: can tax credits be considered public money? Here's Judge Lori Rowe in this week's hearing.
The monies here never enter the public treasury, and they're not revenues. A tax credit is a far cry from, you know, an expenditure or an appropriation by the legislature. And we said so.
Still, Steve Johnson says it could go either way.
If you accept the notion that foregoing tax revenues in substance is the same thing as and getting the revenues and spending the revenues, wow. Imagine how much more there could be by way of litigation. That's a genuine concern for the courts.
In 2015, Leon County Circuit Judge George Reynolds threw out the case, saying the union did not have legal standing. The First District Court of Appeal is still considering the case. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Charter schools, virtual schools, and alternative schools have been held up as positive substitutes for kids who are struggling in a traditional public school setting. And several reports have found that students do as well as, or sometimes better, in charters. But a new report from Johns Hopkins University finds that success may not be carrying over into graduation rates. Lynn Hatter spoke with one of the study's authors.
The study compared grads between different types of schools. Robert Balfans is co-author of the study, and he found that of the 200 low graduation rate high schools in Florida, 49% of them were alternative schools like virtual and charters.
This idea is sort of creeping up that if kids struggle, they sort of need a different school. And so when some places, instead of kids, when they start to struggle in their first high school, instead of trying to help them right then, they sort of let them bounce around for a while and then say, you know, I think there's this really good other school for you. And what often happens then is that they've fallen pretty far behind, and now we put all the kids that have fallen pretty far behind together in a school, and it's almost overwhelming for them to do much. And then what they say is, well, these kids are such challenged kids that any graduation rate's okay. Because even if our graduation rate's only 30 or 40%, they all would have dropped out otherwise. But the problem is if the number of those schools grow and the number of those outcomes, then we'll never keep raising our graduation rates. And for example, in Florida, it's at about 76%. And after some good growth, it's sort of most recently sort of stalled out, right? And now it's 6 points below the national average. So we're just asking people to take a deeper look. Many of these alternative and virtual and schools, for example, do great work. But we really need to take a close eye on them, because if we fall back on this idea that challenged kids, lesser outcomes are okay for them, well, the only kids that aren't graduating now are challenged kids. And if we don't find good answers for them, we won't keep raising our graduation rates.
So when we're talking about graduates, we're talking about the time they started ninth grade to the time they completed the 12th. What about in situations where a student may have started in the ninth grade, possibly failed, then switched to an alternative school? Are those alternatives faulted here?
When we looked in some states, even in the alternative space, the addition of those extra years has ranged anywhere from just a few more points to the biggest state, 16% graduation points, which seems impressive. But in that same state, that just got the average graduation rate for alternative schools up to 50%, which still meant that, you know, half the kids were not graduating even with extra time.
States that fared the worst, like Florida, you said was number two for this problem, are they ones that have actively pushed for alternatives? Is that an accurate interpretation?
Because we see big state differences. In some states, alternative schools do much better than others. In some states, virtual schools do better. In some states, charter schools do amazing. And then in other states, they don't do that great. And what we really argue is we think the difference is differences in oversight, accountability, and capacity building. And then in many places, these schools have sort of existed on the side. Like they're off on the side as something different, with all the attention being on just the regular district schools. And that's very appropriate, because still most kids are not graduating from regular district schools. But as these other sectors grow, if we don't give them good oversight and good accountability and good capacity building, we were sort of raising this report, there is a danger that could sort of slow down our progress towards raising the graduation rate.
So this study is not saying that charters are bad or virtual schools are bad, but that there are issues within the system that may hinder student success.
Our intention was, and our data doesn't support that, like this sector is better or worse than that sector. Charters are better than alternatives, or regular better than alternatives or charters, or et cetera. It just says that, one, we notice great differences in states and how much these schools are used. Two, great differences in states and the outcomes of these schools, which again is that quality argument. And that really people have to be very thoughtful that all of these schools have a role to play in like the ecosystem of getting everyone to graduate, but the balance really matters. And it just seems in some places people are betting too much on the idea that challenged kids need specialized schools, and that's both overwhelming those schools and sort of making some of the regular schools sort of, you know, ease off in their supports. And we're saying that's the problematic combination that we have to look out for.
Balfans says the study has generated interest in learning more about state policies and performance, and he says Johns Hopkins is planning on looking at that next. Each study takes about a year to complete, so a report on that issue would come out sometime next spring. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
There's been a lot of talk about Zika this week and how Congress could help combat the mosquito-borne disease through funding. Florida Governor Rick Scott and other stakeholders even traveled to Washington, D.C., hoping a deal could be struck to fund the effort. So far, there are a number of proposals already on the table, including a bipartisan effort by Florida's two senators. Sasha Cordner has that story.
In late April, Democratic U.S. Senator Bill Nelson filed legislation fully funding President Obama's request to fight the Zika virus. The $1.9 billion request is one Obama made months ago. So far, $600 million of unused Ebola funds have been redirected to help with the Zika fight. Weeks later, though, Nelson's legislation never got called up for a vote, despite efforts to do so.
But unfortunately, there is not one Republican senator that is a co-sponsor. And it doesn't make sense because the spread of the Zika virus is not a partisan issue.
Since then, Nelson has worked on an amendment with former presidential candidate and fellow Florida Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican, and it still fully funds the president's request.
And so I urge my colleagues here in the Senate and the House as well to look at the proposal that Senator Nelson and I will introduce, to offer their input, and ultimately to sign on and get this passed.
There's at least two other Senate proposals with a $1.1 billion figure. Both Rubio and Nelson say that's not enough, but Governor Rick Scott may have a different view.
I've heard about a lot of different proposals today. I don't know which proposal is the right proposal. What's important to me is we do it now.
Still, Scott says the $1.9 billion would still be welcome as long as it's spent on Zika. Scott spoke recently in Washington, D.C. after he met with Republican congressmen about Zika funding. That includes Rubio. He also met with some federal agency people, including U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell. So Scott says while in D.C., he requested 5,000 Zika preparedness kits as well as additional resources for the state's mosquito control districts. That includes the Lee County Mosquito Control District led by Executive Director Wayne Gale. He not only recently met with the governor to discuss Zika preparations, he also traveled with Scott to Washington, D.C. to provide some recommendations to congressional leaders on how some of the Zika fund should be spent should that money become available. Gale says that includes more funding for epidemiology and laboratory capacity, or ELC, grants.
We were recommending that assistance that's already being provided be increased. I think it's at $26 million now, and we'd asked it be increased to $50 million.
Gale says the public can also help by eliminating breeding sources around your home and getting rid of the places mosquitoes will reproduce to prevent the spread of Zika. As of Friday, there were 112 cases in Florida, which still leads the nation in the number of travel-related cases. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Enterprise Florida, the state's business development arm, received no new funding from the legislature this year for economic incentive programs. Governor Rick Scott has said that means it's time for the agency to transition to depend on more private funding. And Regan McCarthy reports it appears that could mean a significant restructuring.
Governor Rick Scott asked former Department of Children and Families Secretary David Wilkins to help identify $6 million in savings in the Enterprise Florida budget.
Based on what happened with this legislative session, I asked David Wilkins to come do a review of Enterprise Florida. We've got to live in reality. Right or wrong, the legislature is not going to fund the quick action closing fund, and I don't see any reason that's going to change this next session. We've got to think about how we're spending our money.
And during a recent meeting with Enterprise Florida board members, Wilkins announced he'd found some places to make cuts.
So I believe there is a $6 million opportunity that we can cut costs, that we can then take advantage of that money and use it other places.
One way Wilkins says the agency can cut costs is by requiring its employees to follow the same rules for travel and expense reimbursement that state workers follow. Scott says he'd like to see that change adopted right away.
I think one of the issues that will present well what we're trying to do to make sure everybody understands we're watching our money is to go ahead and adopt the state travel policy. I think it's the right thing to do. We've done it. We did it with a couple years ago with Citizens Insurance, and it was the right thing to do.
But Wilkins also proposed some more difficult changes. He says to move forward with no quick action closing fund, a pot of money which the agency had hoped to use as an economic incentive to attract jobs and businesses to the state, Enterprise will need to refocus its mission.
Let's be more proactive, particularly now with our marketing campaign, to go to businesses and recruit the type of businesses we think are a good match to Florida, rather than just answering the mail. Figuring out how to exploit the different assets that we have. But the one key point that I really notice is from international is probably our last great frontier. There are companies all over, particularly in Europe, who are really interested in coming to Florida.
But Wilkins recommends a narrowed focus internationally. He says Enterprise Florida should drop locations that aren't creating a good return on investment and use that money to double down in places that have performed well. And he admits all of that restructuring will require some layoffs. He's proposing a reduction of 27 employees and redirection and training for others. Right now, Wilkins says the majority of Enterprise employees aren't focused on what he says are the agency's core missions.
And of the 90 employees of EFI, only about 15 of them are focused on true business development. Of the 90 employees, only about 19 of them are focused on international trade.
Enterprise officials say they intend to discuss implementation of many of Wilkins' recommendations. The tentative plan is to move forward with restructuring efforts during the agency's September meeting. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. And from Florida Tax Watch Prudential Productivity Awards, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost savings ideas on June 21st in Jacksonville, sponsored by Prudential, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plans. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.